Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Masonic Home Companion. I'm your host for the next little while of Masonic Things Masonic, and hopefully will be entertaining and interesting and informative. And always love the introduction from West End Blues by J. Oliver, 1924. And the horn there you hear is apparently one of the very first horn solo pieces by a really young trumpeter that became quite famous, and you and I know him as brother Louis Armstrong. So you know, always in the background. It gains us any cachet or any currency to be part of an organization that. That has some notable people in it, entertainers, political leaders, lions of industry, and science, the arts, medicine. But it does illustrate that if I knew more about your work, it will come forward in this type of audience posthumously. We don't walk around saying, "Well, you're a wonderful fellow. Look at you know you're just startling." That wouldn't be proper. It would be bad form for us to do that. So just like all these other fellows that we talk about, you know, the celebrity of Freemasonry. I'm not a big fan of celebrity, as you know. But we are an order that is inherently based on merit. Sometimes I think we get blindsided a bit or short-sighted. And we like celebrity. Everybody does. And remember, everybody everywhere likes to feel special. When you and I greet a fellow, anybody, man or woman or child, we make them feel special. And the essence of a good Mason, I think, is to provide, you know, the people that are meeting you with that sense that you're giving them your absolute, undivided, and dedicated attention, so that the moment is important to you or to me. And I hope you know that you should be careful around me, because I'm expecting that you carry yourself with a degree of sophistication uncommon this day, that you find, even when your guard is let down, that you have a natural capacity to be graceful. Use your manners is really what we would have said in the 17th and 18th century. We are of that period, I think, in a way. You and I, certainly not. Let's not flatter ourselves. There's no need to be, you know, that would be a conceit to think, oh, gee, I'm from a lost period of time. But, you know, it would be wrong, too, to think that we're not influenced by our past. When somebody would say to me, you know, do you think that Freemasonry is influenced by the events of the mystery schools of ancient Egypt? I would simply say this: do you think that the what's going on in our parliament is influenced by Greece, by Rome, by feudalism, by the advancements in Britain? Well, I'd like to think that the structure perhaps is, but the failings and maneuverings are what they have always been. The governance and authority always become an irritation for the people when they fail to become representative. That's a note from our friend, Thomas Hobbes. Representation, the only legitimacy to any kind of government, as he said. What was he, about 15th century, 16th? 15th, I think, was that the government needed to be a representative. Of course, he was a dyed-in-the-wool monarchist. Different times, and it certainly makes sense, can't it? At the beginning of the 17th century, permanent English settlements were begun in North America. The people of Great Britain had just passed through the reign of an age of faith into the age of reason. You know, that's the age of enlightenment. In the realm of the former, there was such absolute intellectual laziness and indifference to the exercise of reason in speculative matters that men accepted tenets of religion and politics, however absurd, as truths and gave no thought to them. Theology was like a cast iron machine and utterly inflexible. It fashioned social life in its most minute detail. The people were simply passive portions of that machine, obedient to its ecclesiastic movers. Lazy, intellectual laziness will be the downfall of, it has been the downfall of a lot of good people. The monastery governed the throne and its subjects as a rigid master. And for centuries, there had been very little improvement in the condition of its inhabitants. At length, the glare of the moral volcano that had suddenly burst out in Germany shot across, you know, saying, this is absolutely enough. This is absurd. These are, we see a bit of that going on today, you know, with the Pope trying to make him, you know, trying to create some balance with what has been, a huge organization. Has nothing, again, absolutely, to my mind, nothing to do with the faith of these wonderful people, but with the politics and business of religion. A secular revolt assumed formidable proportions. And at the close of that same year, when the right of private judgment was proclaimed at Spires, the English House of Commons, the representatives of the people presented a petition to King Henry VIII, which contained the germs of the English Reformation. It accused the clergy of disloyalty and immorality and ironic, eh? And attributed the disorders which affected the realm to the malign influence of the ecclesiastics. The king presented this petition to the bishops for an answer. That answer was arrogant and offensive to the House of Commons. The latter stood firm in the position of accuser and champion for the laity and waged a bitter war with the clergy. Henry, stimulated by his love for Anne Boleyn, and angered by, I'm more inclined to think misogynist than, you know, romantic, but who am I? And angered by the opposition of the church to his unholy scheme of divorcement from his queen, united with the commons and employed the resolute Thomas Cromwell to lead a movement from the disseverance of the civil government of England from the controlling spiritual power of Rome. Thomas Cromwell did it with a high hand, sanctioned and assisted by the Parliament, for already the rule of the people through representatives was recognized. That body, by law, suppressed all the monasteries in the kingdom, confiscated their property, and compelled the ecclesiastics to work for their own subsistence. "Go spin, Jadis, go spin," was the unfeeling remark of Cromwell to some aged nuns. By law, Henry was the supreme head of the Church of England, a pontiff of a church in rebellion, and so was established the principle that canon or ecclesiastic laws must be subservient to the civil laws. It was a new thing under the sun. England was now partially freed from a long political bondage, and the age of reason dawned. The English mind was thoroughly aroused to action. Wonderful social change followed, and during the reign of the adroit trimmer, Queen Elizabeth, all classes had more freedom than ever before. Yet the laity was not wholly free. Henry had not only specially changed the theology of the rituals of the Church of England, and there appeared three powerful and antagonistic parties in the realm. These were the English party, or churchmen, who adhered to and enforced the doctrines and rituals of the Church of Rome, but who gave their allegiance to the English monarch, and not to the Pope. The papal party, or supporters of the authority of the Roman hierarchy, and the doctrinal Protestants, who were disliked by the others. When Parliament established a liturgy for the Church of England, the latter refused conformity to it, for they acknowledged no authority but the Bible in matters of religion. You can hear this today with, you know, the canonical law being put forth as superior, not equal, but superior to civil law. You know, that ain't going to happen. We get, of course, the laws written by lawyers. It was in derision, but soon became an honorable title. There were more people. Get this. When Parliament established a liturgy for the Church, for the Church of England, the latter refused conformity to it. Right? The latter being the Protestants. For they acknowledged no authority but the Bible in matters of religion. They were more austere in manners, more simple in their worship, and demanded greater purity of life. And so they acquired the name of Puritans. It was given in derision, but soon became an honorable title. Each class was intolerant. And for more than a century and a half, there was a chaotic, triangular contest between the English churchmen, the Roman Catholics, and the Puritans, which caused many of each class to seek peace in the forests of America. But reason swayed the age with a potent scepter and stamped its insignia of authority upon the movements of society. Individuals and associations found new and promising fields of action, the most attractive of which was the virgin soil of America. As we have seen, its worth was known and fairly estimated at the beginning of the 17th century, and then dawned the era of settlements within the domain of our republic, the American Republic, now at the noontide of success and turning the wilderness everywhere into a blooming garden. Maybe that's what we'll call it. We'll go with that for this day. The condition of the rural population of England had greatly improved under the order of things. Down to the time of Henry VIII, there had been very little improvement since the Romans left the island. There was not much tillage, and that little was unskillfully done. Vast forests and fens covered the land, and malaria, wholesale exhalations, was a perpetual scourge. Things we don't really hear about too much. Eh? The population was sparse and increased very slowly. It did not exceed 5 million in the whole island of Britain, while Henry VIII ascended the throne. The food of that common people was not equal in its nutrition and variety, nor their clothing and comfort to that of our Indians when Europeans first came to America. Our Indians lived in better habitation than did their British contemporaries. Pestilence and famine kept the rural population sparse. The ecclesiastics rioted in coarse luxuries, and the morals of the towns were beastly in the extreme. At the beginning of the 17th century, or 100 years later, all of this had materially changed. The methods of agriculture had greatly improved and its bounds immensely enlarged. Implements were better and tillage was far more productive. The farmers generally had an abundance of good food, lived in better houses, pewter dishes had taken the place of wooden ones, feather beds those of straw and coarse wool, and the yeoman was fond of entertaining his neighbors. Clover had been introduced from the Netherlands and increased the food for sheep and cattle. Gardens had begun to be cultivated. From the Netherlands had come the hop. Also the cabbage, lettuce, apricot, gooseberry, muskmelon, and apple. Cherries had come from France. Currants from Greece. Plums from Italy. And from Flanders, the Flemings had brought the rose and other fragrant plants, natives of the East. Rural feasts were common among the yeomanry, And the materials for good cheer were enumerated by the following lines. This is something you can, that's really quite nice. Here's a sort of a toast, I guess, or an encouragement. Good bread and good drink, a good fire in the hall, brawn, pudding and sauce, and good mustard withal. Beef, mutton, and pork, shred pies of the best, pig, veal, goose, and capon, and turkey well-dressed. Cheese, apples, and nuts, jolly carols to hear. All these in the country are counted good cheer. Well, aren't they, isn't that nice? All these in the country are counted good cheer. Yum, yum. Let's sit down together. In cities and among the... I'm just going to wrap up. Just to give you a bit of a taste, because we're said to be heavily influenced by the thinking of the Enlightenment. Well, let's hope that we, you know, that period that is being described as intellectual laziness, let's hope that when the spark was lit, you know, that the people writing about us, writing and forming the notions of organizational Freemasonry had stopped being lazy. Certainly, I think it's not to say that everybody was intellectually lazy, but the preponderance, people of power were, and the people were, this is that cliche, we were following like sheep. Somebody said it, we didn't give it a second thought, we just shrugged and said, hey, how it must be. And then you can see that we developed into an intolerant bunch. The Puritans were not, you know, easy. They were not easy. They were that notch above. Now, how do you live around somebody like that? That thinks that, you know, that everything is in that purest sense. They're intolerable. Better that they travel across the water to find their own privacy and place and do whatever mayhem they can cause out of their sense of piety, I guess. Better there than around me. In cities and among the nobility, rapidly increasing wealth had fostered a taste for luxuries. Dwellings, furniture, and dress felt its influence. So we get into the arts, the craftsmen. Elegant and substantial houses were built. Furniture was elaborately carved and inlaid, and glass mirrors had been introduced from France early in the reign of Elizabeth. Carpets from Turkey, which English weavers soon imitated, took the place of floors of rushes and mats, on which royalty had before trodden. Chairs were cushioned with velvet coverings, and costly beds and bedsteads were seen. In many houses were ornamental French clocks, and knives were seen on English dinner tables, but forks were not used whilst Elizabeth lived. An old chronicler tells us of a merry scene in the palace of Henry VIII. On the morning after the supple-kneed Archbishop Cranmer pronounced the marriage of his king with Anne Boleyn lawful, the new queen received visits of congratulations from the whole court and the archbishop and several prelates in full canonicals. Henry was delighted with the honors paid to his beautiful wife. And while they were pressing about her and both ladies and gentlemen were giving her tokens of their regard, the king went to a small cabinet and unlocked it, and taking from it a French clock which he had bought in France while he was there with Anne, when she was a marchioness, he brought it and put it in her hands as a public pledge of his love and consistency while time should endure. It was of silver gilt, richly cased, engraved and ornamented with fleur-de-lis and little heads. On the top sits a lion holding the arms of England, which are also on their sides. It's about 16 inches in height. The costume of this period, what we would be wearing if we were part of this party, we are considering was a little less extravagant in mode and richness of materials than it had been when Elizabeth was in her prime, for Puritan simplicity better suited good taste. Crimson and blue velvets embroidered with gold were still worn by the rich and noble, and the ruff was yet seen around the necks of both men and women, but somewhat diminished in volume. Jewelry was yet used in excess, and perfume gloves bordered with silver were common among the rich. Headdresses were of every variety and pattern, but generally were not offensive to good taste. The pastimes of the common people were ball playing, bowling, archery, and rude theatrical exhibitions, while the gentry engaged in bull baiting and horse racing out of doors, and chess and backgammon amused them in hall and castle. Learning until late in Elizabeth's reign had been much neglected. Nobles and clergy were ignorant. That's the term you use when somebody has no education beyond their own experience. Truly. Mm. It sort of gets under your skin when you hear it, but never changes. But now a mighty impulse had been given to literature in England, for it was the age of Spencer and Shakespeare. Not one in ten of the gentry could write his or her name. The father of Shakespeare could only make his mark with a pen. The fine arts were very little encouraged. Henry VIII, who possessed good taste, caused some very fine buildings to be erected and invited to his court painters and sculptors from abroad. Hobbien, the painter, came from Switzerland, and Tordaglio, the sculptor, from Florence, but Elizabeth had no artistic taste. And we find only one eminent painter during her reign, Nicholas Hillard, to whom she sat for her miniature several times. She encouraged art so far as it ministered to the gratification of her vanity. Yep. This is a picture of the social condition in England when the inhabitants of the realm began to make permanent settlements in America at the beginning of the 17th century. The Tudor dynasty had ended with Elizabeth, and that of the Stuarts had begun. James VI of Scotland, the only son of Mary, Queen of Scots, had ascended the throne as James I of England in 1603. He was in private and public an unwashed, ill-mannered, vulgar, and contemptible man, fond of gross shows on which he wasted the treasures of the kingdom, and so great was his egotism that he considered himself more wise and learned than any man in his realm, in church or state. He was a bigoted believer in the royal prerogative or exclusive privileges exercised by divine right, and he was a fickle tyrant who gave continual uneasiness to his subjects. This, however, was the monarch who granted charters to the London and Plymouth companies, authorizing them to make settlements in America. Well, well, well. So, thank you, James, the first of England and sixth of Scotland, for that. The Age of Enlightenment. Cultural movement of intellectuals that began in the late 17th and 18th century, emphasizing the reason and individualism rather than tradition. Its purpose was to reform society using reason, challenge ideas grounded in tradition and faith, and advance knowledge through the scientific method. It promoted scientific thought, skepticism, and intellectual interchange. It opposed superstition and intolerance, with the Catholic Church a favorite target. Some Enlightenment philosophies collaborated with enlightened despots, who were absolute rulers who tried out some of their new governmental ideas in practice. The ideas of the Enlightenment have had a long-term major impact on the culture, politics, and governments of the Western world. Now, here's some references you might find interesting. You don't have to read all of their work, but originating about 1650. Now, think about it. This is leading up to that period where we see Grand Lodge. All that Grand Lodge stuff was sparked by philosophers, the Baruch Spinoza, what was he? He was a Dutchman. John Locke, who you gotta like. Pierre Bayle, B-A-Y-L-E, Voltaire. And the physicist, Isaac Newton. Now remember, this was a period where the Royal Society was formed. Was that about 1643, I think, somewhere in there. Ruling princes often endorsed and fostered these three figures. Spinoza, Bale, Voltaire, and the physicist. You know, you're going to hang around with somebody, you might as well hang around with Newton. The scientific revolution is closely tied to the Enlightenment, as its discoveries overturned many traditional concepts and introduced new perspectives on nature and man's place in it. The Enlightenment flourished until about 1790 to 1800, after which the emphasis on reason gave way to Romanticism's emphasis on emotion, and a counter-Enlightenment gained force. In France, Enlightenment was based in the salons and culminated in the great Encyclopedia edited by Denis Diderot and Jean Leroy D'Alembert, with contributions by hundreds of leading philosophers, intellectuals, like Voltaire, Rousseau, Montesquieu. Some 25,000 copies of the 35-volume set were sold, half of them outside France. The new intellectual forces spread to urban centers across Europe, notably England, Scotland, and German states, the Netherlands, Poland, Russia, Italy, Austria, and Spain, and then jumped the Atlantic into the European colonies, where it influenced Benjamin Franklin, Thomas Jefferson, and played a major role in the American Revolution. The political ideas of the Enlightenment influenced the American Declaration of Independence, the United States Bill of Rights, the French Declaration of the Rights of Man and of the Citizen, and the Polish-Lithuanian Constitution of the 3rd May, 1791. So think about that just as the field that was cultivated for us, the intellectual field, the social and cultural changes that were occurring, just like they always do. It gave rise to seeds that had been planted a long time ago, the seeds of curiosity and knowledge, the search for truth. And I think that has some merit. I mean, back in the background, I'd like you just to think, too, about, you know, a very practical and I know much more mundane level, the matter of Scottish Rite and York Rite. And compared to what we're just talking about, the Age of Reason, of course, these organizations are mundane, but not to be smirch, I know that I'll I don't mean it. Yes, that's far too pithy. But comparatively, put it into some context. I just want to read to you about the acquired taste of Freemason. You and I are, this is because probably we're not common. This is not common. Becoming better than you are is very, very difficult. It's a pain in the rear end. It takes much longer than we expect. Oh, well, just do the bumper sticker. I'm really trying to, you know, can somebody send me the source of that makes good men better? Just somebody help me with that. Sometimes I have these fleeting moments of delusional thought where I think, oh, that makes perfect sense. And then it's like when somebody hands me a copy of, you know, Freemasons for Dummies, and they say, well, you know, here, add this to your library. Well, I'm embarrassed. I'm embarrassed. It's not like, oh, statistics for dummies where you have, for me, it's like, you know, a short course so I can have all the little reminders and prompts at my fingertips. Freemasons for Dummies, I felt, you know, an insult. I would think, you know, if the dummy is not of us, then great. But if that's the best way, you know, and the clamor made me feel, the clamor amongst brethren for that, made me realize just how starved we are for intellectual discourse, how hungry we have been. And then I began to think, now you do the same thing. Take a look at it and reason this through. Why are we so hungry? Oh, don't be so rude to think that it was just because we're indifferent and silly and don't care about it, because that's never been the case. That's just arrogance to say something or even think something like that. Or just to criticize the man. Oh, there, you know, you're just something's wrong with the man. That's so simplistic. It doesn't even deserve comment. It is because we had other preoccupations, other things in front of us that required our attention. No, we're very generous. Just reading about the Age of Enlightenment, you know, moving from age of superstition into the age of reason, we have to be generous in understanding that, you know, we're not talking in absolutes. We're talking in relative terms, that there were major social influences. Yeah, of course. And you and I are influenced by those things the same way they were, until we begin to stick our head up from the clamor, take a look around, and realize if we can put some of this, that's what's happening around us, in context. Oh, my goodness, to do that, you do invite criticism. Of course, uppity, get back in line. Don't be doing that kind of thinking. It's so much easier if we don't think about it. So much easier if we don't ask the difficult question. The rights of women, let's not ask. The rights of the homosexual, gay, lesbian population, let's not ask them. The right to die, let's not ask that, you know. Unpleasant little skeletons in our closet. We'll get around to this, but we're probably not mature enough yet, intellectually mature enough to be able to address those things. But we will. We will, inevitably. Inevitably. So I'm going, so this notion of becoming, you know, becoming, first is little different than being. The idea of being, you are what you are. I am that I am, that I am. Well, this is taking that as raw matter, raw material, and improving it. Improving what? Well, yeah, we had those, that whole wave of thinking that everything natural was beautiful. And anything sort of civilized, anything was artificial, and wrong. And we still see that today. You know, grab your bag of herbs and whatever nature can produce, but don't go near anything produced by science, because we know that science is a corruption of the natural state. Can you believe that kind of thinking? Where do we get this notion that there's something beyond what's natural? You and I, mitochondria, molecular level, what part of that? You know, are you the free radical out there, that element that doesn't fit? Well, I guess then you can claim that you're in charge and you have an understanding of something unnatural. In the meantime, we're all part of this great universe, I would say. I think that's fair to say. Of course, I tend to lean toward a very, very, very weak, intellectually weak understanding of the Kabbalah, that sense of oneness and unification, the components that fit together into this miraculous world that we live in, morally and spiritually. This self-improvement that we've taken on, have we really? We don't really naturally take it on. We go through the initiation, and it's explained to us. Doesn't mean anybody says and comes up and prods you. We usually hear somebody talking about the journey. You know, you started your journey, blah, 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 may it be wonderful. Nobody really tells you what in the hell that means. It's, what journey? Well, you know, yeah, I understand a journey. Go from one point to another point. Nobody talks to you about your motivation. Or anything else, just a journey. There you go. Now I've done my bit. It's like saying, now you're a member of the craft, and tomorrow the sun's going to come up. There you go. Good luck. Well, that's where I think we get the intellectual impairment, is that we need to be able to discuss the meaning of this. And do we? Absolutely not. And I say that in absolute terms. Absolutely not. I've never, ever, ever once seen anybody sit down when a fellow comes through the door for the very first time to explain anything about the context, to enrich the experience for him. Not once. Don't get me started on this nonsense about Leo Taxil and the bloody goat. God, how embarrassing. That's what I've heard. I'm ashamed of this. That's what I hear. Of course, just as a little sidebar here, can I do that? Taxel didn't have an axe to grind with us. He was out to embarrass the Catholic Church. Did a good job. Used us to do it. Did a damn good job. But does anybody point the finger at the Catholic Church about it? Hell no. Point the finger at you and I. He was a charlatan. He confessed openly, and he laughed about it. He admitted readily this was taking a shot at the Catholic Church. That was not a man you want to screw with a whole lot. Do I applaud his methods? Well, I acknowledge him. No, because it involves something that's very sacred and important to me, the order. But the lesson learned, we were used. We were had. That wasn't that long. It was, you know, just before the end of the 19th century. So, of course, we would go to ground. We'd be very cautious, you know. Even today on the radio show, you know, we see with Blog Talk, we see more people talking about Freemasonry in terms of the, you know, the dangers and the perils. And it's like, oh, geez, okay. You and I might look at a waterfall and think, that's so gorgeous. And other people think, oh, gee, you could fall off the edge. It all depends on the perspective, isn't it? And they're both probably right. Are we dangerous? To the despot, we're dangerous. To the blindly superstitious, we're dangerous. To the idiot, we're pretty dangerous. But are we going to go out and do something? Are we aggressive? No. If you know, intellectually, I think that's where the danger lies, not in any other way. Here's a, one of the secrets of Freemasonry. The core of the philosophies are that we're pacifists. Oh, does that make us stupid? No. Do we put down our guard? You know better. But the risk that we are is to the zealots. They just want to continue to fight, carry on the battle. You and I step up, the bigger man. Put that weapon down, you moron, and put out your hand to this fellow here. Work together mutually and you can create a better life. And if you damn well can't do it, we're going to show you how. And if you can't figure it out, we'll show you how twice. And if you still can't figure it out, we aren't going away. These ideas are transfixed in the being of humanity. It takes longer than we expect to improve, and it's harder than we could ever possibly imagine. So think about it. It's easier just to shrug our shoulders and become sheep. But just follow in line, isn't it? And we can rationalize it. Oh, you know, it's my age. Oh, it's my lodge. Oh, it's, you know, somebody else is doing. We can always find that, you know. Of course, we just rationalize. It's easier to defy that. Yes, of course. Our lodges are crowded with what I call the initiated diaspora. Men who came to the door of Freemasonry unaware of the daunting challenges, the risks, the potential for failure. It's hard when you try something. It's not like, oh, I'm going to try it and everything's going to fall at my feet and be perfect the first time out. Nope, that's not the way the world is. The world is hard and harsh, and natural law has no appeal process. Oh, the sentence is, you're done, you're baked, you're burned. That's the way it is, and we all absolutely know it, whether we accept it or not. To ease my burden, could have said I would abandon my brother. But I can't. So that's thinking selfishly. That's the conceit. That's the ego. Why do I worry about somebody else's dilemma? I'm really talking here about myself. I'm not talking about you. I'm just talking about my own struggle. And I'm presuming that I'm not alone in the planet. It would be reckless to think there is a task for me that is part of my development, mentoring him toward the enlightenment. That would be reckless of me. If the tasks were easy, we would not be initiated. They are purposeful challenges. They're there for a reason. Two, discovered what is that purpose is part of what brings meaning to a life. Weak-willed Masons are the fodder that distracts us. Doesn't mean that everybody comes through fully vitalized and functioning, aware, keen. No. People come through the door tired, burdened, distracted, some with great ability, some with slim ability, some with intellectual capacity, some with less. But they distract us. They distract us. Because we're not sitting down to the discussion. And I'm not saying kick them out and wave off their heads and not. But without that, perhaps we're better for the effort. Without petty distraction, bickering and whining, without question, we would be focused on growing the ideas of Freemasonry. Oh my goodness, could you imagine a focus on theology and philosophy? We would be well on. Today, humility has morphed into self-consciousness that requires a great suppression of fact. We have a confusing mixture of chain of command and self-directed learning that needs our collective attention, gentlemen. We're going to have somebody tell you, can you imagine? This is how we've reduced learning to somebody telling you. This is the corporate view. Learn it. Nice try. It doesn't work. Nice try. And you reach a certain point where it's laughable. Don't even try it, you know. Oh, you must learn this? Yeah, okay, fine. Here's your speeding ticket, Mr. Graham. Yes, I'll never do that again. Right, sorry. Am I reckless? No. But do I do things because somebody else orders me around? No, sorry. No, I have to think it through. And do I see the greater good? Yeah. I think that's pretty obvious. And do I lose that sense of, do any of us lose that sense of individuality? No. No, thank goodness. But we have to sort this out. We're going to order this. The chain of command is, what I mean by that is, you know, telling. You know, you're at this rank, this is what you need to know. Well, man, I don't know how you do that. I really don't. I think, because I'm sitting here in this, we're sitting there in this organization that fuels philosophical discussion. I got a really, really, really good note from a past grandmaster just recently, Daniels, talking about, you know, some of the comments about modernizing the work, the individual, and things like that. And he made, you know, he just hit on the highlights of that the point. So of course, these things, you know, doing things in a particular way is learning, it's defining, it's incredibly important that we don't just make everything so commonplace that it has no significance anymore. We have a confusing mixture, yeah. Stepping onto the level is horizontal, not lateral. Shocking. Was that a little bit? Did I say that out loud? When I step onto the level, if I'm true to that notion of self-improvement, I'm stepping up to your level. I should never expect anybody to step down to mine. I step up. And I think every single one of us does. We step up to the level always. And look around and you think, what is the common notion? I think it's just assumptions. And I don't think it's wrong-mindedness. It's the product of a discussion that's not held. And some people get very, you know, when you have those kind of discussions, what do you see? You see anxiety. And how do you see the anxiety manifest? tempers and irritation. I'm uncomfortable with this topic. I don't know where it's going. I really can't control it. So I'm going to be irritable or withdrawn. I don't have an opinion on this. That tells us a couple of really interesting things. To have a meaningful and productive discussion about things philosophic requires an atmosphere of trust and confidence, where people can say things that haven't necessarily been filtered by political correctness, but we can say things because they're struggling to understand them. Now you'll find that people that aren't used to that will begin quoting, not realizing that this is a process of distillation, is a process of refining the ideas. Not this bloody, tiresome, judgmental crap that goes on in the world of the commons. After 156 years, is that how old we are barely able to best our betters, the citizens ready to take the parapets and the hinted enhancement of ceremony. I don't want to get ahead of myself here. Why doesn't the look and presence of the craft echo the uniqueness of arts, history, science, and philosophy? Where have the antiquarians gone? Discover the Grand Lodge Temple. It does exist. Marble, bronze, powerful, beautiful, of another time. It teases us, doesn't it? It teases us into a belief. Another time, it teases us by leaving us with the notion that what? That it takes a trip. Where this begins to, you know, I see this beautiful Grand Lodge building, and it exists, but it requires a trip to Grimmelshausen, I guess you can say it that way. Don't take a word for it. Go and Google this one. You'll find out where it is. G-E-R-M-E-L-S-H-A-U-S-E-N. Wishing, wanting, believing, creation. It's where my Grand Lodge is. The symbol of the power, not of us, but of the ideas. Something beyond. Something that is manifest. The cathedral. The great cathedral. Does that make... Yeah, it does exist. Heretic that I am. Anyway, I'm going to leave that. Thank you. Yes, of course, obviously I'm indulging myself here again to this today. Do I get to bring up some of my pet peeves here? I don't know. Come not between the dragon and his wrath, in King Lear, says Shakespeare. The earth has music for those who listen, he claims. I want to, you know, we talk about the development of the taste in the arts and sciences. Shakespeare claimed that the object, I don't want to get into the battle of whether it was Spencer that did all this and Shakespeare. Remember, we just heard that Shakespeare's father could only leave his mark with a pen. One generation later, we have William Shakespeare. He explains that why, you know, we do these things. The dialogue, the part that's always missing in Freemasonry is the explanation. And because it changes, we always improve on it. The object of art, he explains, is to give life a shape. So I took from that the more you study, the more you can shape your life. Now, Freemasonry is, I think, in my mind, requiring that or asks us to develop a sense of understanding of the arts and sciences. So when I think of the arts, I think of theater, I think of the art galleries, I think of music. Does it mean we all have to become, you know, if people already have a fence at anything classical because it's beyond their pay grade, I think, well, there's your problem. Years ago, we would not have been able to sit down and listen to Handel or Mendelssohn or Mozart. That was for the rich people. That was for the wealthy, the gentry. Now, you and I can save up, the cost of a few packs of cigarettes, and we can listen to some of the finest performers that the world can produce. But we've lost that sense of reason. It no longer matters. It's sort of commonplace. Better that, you know, it's sort of replaced by things vulgar. Better that we can have, you know, something that excites our taste than is healthy for us. So, you know, it's always something salacious, something titillating that may in the long run be quite unhealthy for us. It makes me really wonder, how do we do this? Well, the how is not possible unless you want it. Do you want to develop, and this is for each one of us, again, no discussion of this ever anywhere. Do we want to fulfill the requirements of Freemasonry? Seems like we could say that in a yes or no. Then if we do, then we need to be able to open our minds and explore. And exploring the arts, I can't think that that's a bad thing. I didn't come from the gentry. I remember the first time I went into an art gallery and realized that those benches were there for me to sit down. And then I had to figure out what I was looking at. Well, I'm looking at this painting, and then I knew nothing about it. And then I figured out that I had to go and do some reading to understand what I was looking at. And then years later now, I can walk in and have a slim sense that I can appreciate the interpretation that the artist gives to his or her work. The expression. Was it Hobbes that said, who was it that said that a poet is only a person that has a capacity for intense emotion? And I think, I remember a few years ago when I was an entered apprentice hearing some older, some of my seniors complaining bitterly about having to listen to somebody read poetry in a lodge. And I thought, you know, for me, it was like, oh, this is kind of interesting. I don't have people reading poetry around me in my normal life. This is pretty cool. And to listen to these fellows, they were, I don't know, it just sounded very meager. Have more than you show. Speak less than you know. That's Shakespeare. Doubt thou the stars are fire. Doubt that the sun doth move. Doubt truth to be a liar, and never doubt I love. Yeah. Love all, trust few, do wrong to no one. So, you've heard me throw it out there to you at different times. If Christopher Wren came walking through with some of his ideas, would we have St. Paul's Cathedral today? Hell no. We'd throw him out in the parking lot. We might give him a gig building the parking lot, but he would embellish it with things beautiful. So we can't do that. We have to do things on the cheap. Feeling good about it? Yep, that's what we do. Do it on the cheap. And until we can figure out how to do that, let's save our money. keep it in our vaults. Let's count those coins because that's where the power is. Sorry, I get to indulge. I'm sorry, you know, criticize me. I get to indulge. The power is in the great ideas. Here's one, Christopher Wren. You know, eventually he built things, and here. I've often thought that Christopher Wren wasn't amazing, but I wish he had been. So I dug a little bit, and I came up with a few things. You want to work these into your conversation with your mates? That's great. Says, this could not have been a rumor. In 1691, Aubrey would not then have regarded Wren as even a member of the fraternity. Now, that's... after referring to, Madam, this day, the May, I'll go back, I'm sorry. This day, May the 18th, being Monday after Rogation Sunday, is a great convention at St. Paul's Church of the Fraternity of the Free, and it was stricken out and accepted, was underlined, Masons, where Sir Christopher Wren is to be adopted a brother. This is 1691. And Sir Henry Gardrick of Ye Tower and diverse others, there have been kings that have been of this sodalite. This simple statement, probably hearsay, as Aubrey is not of the craft, has created considerable dissension among Masonic authorities, and it is to be deplored that Aubrey did not wait a few hours and then state what, if anything, had occurred. The controversy, nevertheless, serves the valuable purpose of illustrating how unreliable Masonic historians have been and how slender the threads upon which they have hung the most unequivocal statements. Wren was the most noted architect of his time and the designer and builder of St. Paul's Cathedral in London. His alleged Masonic affiliation went unheralded for 47 years after the date of Aubrey's memoriam, and was first asserted by Dr. James Anderson in his Constitutions of 1738. He failed to mention in it those of 1723. After referring to Deputy Wren and Deputy Grand Master Wren, he boldly asserted that upon the death of Grand Master Arlington of 1685, the lodge met and elected Sir Christopher Wren Grand Master. As usual, falsities clash. Anderson states that Wren was Grand Master in 1685. Aubrey, that he was to join the fraternity in 1691. Master in 1695, and Wren became deputy until 1698, when Wren was re-elevated to the position of Grand Master. Isn't that interesting? Yet still in the South, 1707, the lodges were more and more disturbed, partly by the neglect of the master and wardens, and partly by not having a noble Grand Master at London, and the annual assembly was not duly attended. Grand Master at London and the annual assembly was not duly attended. Grandmaster Wren then designed St. Paul's, London, A.D. 1673, and as master of work, had conducted it from the footstone, had the honor to finish the noble cathedral, the finest and largest temple of the Augustine style, except St. Peter's of Rome, and celebrated the capstone when he erected the cross at the top of the cupola in July, A.D. 1708. Some few years after this, Sir Christopher Wren neglected the office of Grand Master, yet the old lodge near St. Paul's and a few more continued their stated meetings. Obviously, most of this is pure invention or a repetition of rumor. It is agreed by all authorities that there was no office of Grand Master in 1685, or for many years thereafter. Furthermore, this could not have been even a rumor in 1691. Else Aubrey, I'll have to find out who Aubrey is. I'll get you that. Else Aubrey would not then half, regarded Wren as not even a member of the fraternity. John Aubrey, that's who we're talking about here. This is the item of written evidence of 17th century English Freemasonry is a fragmentary note by John Aubrey in his Natural History of Wiltshire, commenced in 1656 and completed in 1686. This work remained in manuscript form for many years and was interlined and otherwise altered by the author and even by others before it was finally published in 1847. And that's what I'm reading for. So go and Google John Aubrey, A-U-B-R-E-Y. Everyone else, if Wren was made a Mason in 1691, he and everyone else forgot it before the Grand Lodge was formed in 1717. Wren was still living in 1723 when Anderson drafted and presented the constitutions, which were adopted by the Grand Lodge in that year. Remember, we didn't have, there wasn't a constitution when things started. Although Anderson sought to elevate the fraternity in the public esteem by conferring Masonic memberships and even grand masterships on many prominent figures in history, among others, James I, Charles I, Charles II, James, Charles sort of lost his head about Parliament. A little bit of arrogance will go nowhere. James, we already heard, was a bit of a sod. William III and Sir Edwin Coke, and others, he mentioned Sir Christopher Wren only as King's architect and in connection with the general history of architecture. And then 15 years later, Anderson declares Wren's membership. This phenomenon is explained by the fact that Anderson, also in 1738, added to his list of Grand Masters not only Wren, but Austin the Monk, St. Swithin, St. Dunstan, Henry the Seventh, Cardinal Wolsey, Nimrod, Moses, Solomon, you getting these? Nebuchadnezzar, and Augustus Caesar. You okay with that? Anderson, you good with that? 1738. There we go. There we go. Write it down. It's got to be true. The man, just kidding. I'm doing that on behalf of all of those. Here we go. Love all, trust a few, do wrong to no one. Thanks. That's what our friend Willie Shakespeare. There is no contemporary evidence of Wren's affiliation. None. Preston, in his Illustrations of Masonry, of which 12 editions were published between 1772 and 1812, followed and elaborated upon Anderson's fabulous discursions and its successive editions, added details and particulars. The edition of 1792 stated that Wren patronized Lodge of Antiquity, formerly St. Paul's, for 18 years, presented it with three candlesticks and the mallet by which King Charles II had leveled the foundation stone of St. Paul's Cathedral. Preston stated that such was shown by the records of the Lodge, but does not quote or further describe them, and no such records have ever been found or known to exist. There is no contemporary evidence of Wren's affiliation. In the memoirs of the Wren family, compiled by Sir Christopher's son and published by his grandson, there is no reference to any affiliation of Sir Christopher with the Masonic fraternity or any lodge. The memoirs are silent on the point. They state only the highest or last stone on the top of the lantern was laid by the hands of the surveyor's son, Christopher Wren, deputed by his father in the presence of that excellent artificer, Mr. Arthur Strong, his son, and other free and accepted masons, chiefly employed in the execution of the work. The completion of St. Paul's Cathedral would naturally focus public attention upon Wren to a greater degree than ever before, and the participation of Strong and other Masons in the event would naturally emphasize any connection that Wren had with the society. This event was only about 7 or 9 years prior to the formation of the Grand Lodge in 1717, in which John Theophilus de Solier, Martin Folkes, Martin Clare, and Richard Rawlinson were then, or shortly thereafter, prominent participants. Moreover, all those named were members of the Royal Society of England, of which Wren was president in 1681. Yet none apparently regarded Sir Christopher as a Freemason. Following Wren's death on February 25, 1723, there appeared some 16 notices of his death, funeral services, and burial in St. Paul's. Only two of these notices referred to him as that worthy Freemason. Smith's Pocket Companion for 1735, 36, 37, and 38, which was supposed to contain accurate Masonic information, refers to Wren simply as that excellent architect. Randall Holme, another bit of written evidence of English Freemasonry in the 17th century, consists of several allusions to the society made by Randall Holme in his Academie of Armoury, published in 1688. The author was the third Randall Holme and was deputy to the Garter King of Arms. In that book, he expressed himself thus: "I cannot but honor the fellowship of the Masons because of its antiquity, and the more as being a member of the society called Freemasons. In being conversant amongst them, I have observed the use of these several tools, following some whereof I have seen borne in coats of armor." So, among his papers for several of considerable Masonic interest, the first was the copy of the Gothic Constitutions known as Harleian Manuscript number 2054, which is supposed to have been written by him and copied from an earlier specimen sometime between 1650 and 1686. Though it is possible that it was written earlier by his father, the second item was a scrap of paper with the following form of oath in the same handwriting. "I can't, who couldn't even make this. There are several words and signs of a Freemason to be revealed to you, which, as you will answer before God in the great and terrible day of judgment, you should keep secret and not reveal the same to any of the ears of any person, but with the misses and fellows, masters and fellows of the said Society of Freemasons. So help me God." So there you have at least the context. Even when we're fishing through a lot of things, we really do, we need to be able to rely on the scholars, the historians, the academics, to sort out the difference between this sort of conjecture and opinion. Really, if you think about it, there's so much opinion. How much of it is supported by fact? I don't want to be part of an organization that's like Harry Potter. I don't. I want to be at least have some grounding in fundamental in the philosophy and the history and the cultural development of time, and I do. I feel that very sincerely. But to support it with all of this with conjecture, I think this does us a bit of a disservice. It's like sort of saying that Christopher Wren was a Mason when, you know, I don't want to say things that I don't want to, you know, give him an acknowledgement that wasn't part of him. He's not asking for it. You know, if we wish to know the force of human genius, we should read Shakespeare. If we wish to see the significance of human learning, we may study his commentators. That's from William Hazlitt. So, how am I doing so far? You're getting excited about the winter solstice, I know. It's coming up on Saturday, the 21st of December. This is, by the way, the 307th day of the year. We're celebrating the 3rd of November, the year 6013 Anno Lumine. Wonderful period of time. So, we're doing well so far? Then we'll just top this off with a little bit of a reference to DeSalier on development. You know, after a while, I don't want to always talk about it. It's not like here we have to specifically hit me between the hit me on the forehead with a mallet that with a focus on self-improvement. Sometimes I'm convinced, as many people are, that self-improvement occurs when you're going about the normal course of your business. When ideas come to you where you think that you can be innovative, maybe it's when you're gardening, or maybe it's when you're walking down the street, where an idea comes to you that you can demonstrate and bring forward that you've learned. The learning is beyond the experience. My experience teaches me to treat everybody as a stranger and with suspicion, and therefore fear-based. The reality and truth is strangers are safe. Do we want to accept that? Hell no. Better to soothe. This is where we get into soothing our ego by saying everything that I feel is absolutely accurate. Because I don't know anything, because, you know, there's darkness. Well, there's danger in darkness. Well, we know that's not accurate. But, you know, we have these simplistic ways of thinking about the world and ourselves in it. And I don't know if it always does us any good. Help me here. Help me. I need your advice. My goodness. You know, I'm carrying on here far. My brains are leaking out my ears here today. I need your advice, brother and friends. This is the advice of Montaigne, you know, 16th century. Michel Ecuyem de Montaigne. Lots of people read his work. The people that you and I would think would be, you think what would influence them and what would be in their bookcase? Well, material by Montaigne would be back in the day. So the question we're always asking repeatedly is how to live. This one is use little tricks. Yeah, it's true. It's nice. About academic philosophers, Montaigne was usually dismissive. He disliked their pedantries, and abstractions, but he showed an endless fascination for another tradition in philosophy, that of the great pragmatic schools, which explored such questions as how to cope with a friend's death, how to work up courage, how to act well in morally difficult situations, and how to make the most of life. These were the philosophies he turned to in times of grief or fear, as well as guidance in dealing with every more minor everyday irritations. Now, you and I can quiver, pull the blankets over our head, remain anxious, and wait for the day of reckoning to come. We can do that only by ignoring this type of thing. So, spoiler alert, if you're pulling the comforter up over your head even as we speak, and you don't want to expand your thinking about coping and actually delivering a different way of functioning, turn this off right now. Turn it off right now. You're not going to like what you're going to hear. We're going to talk about, again, we're going to talk about the three most famous systems of thought: Stoicism, Epicureanism, and Skepticism. You okay so far? The philosophies, collectively known as Hellenistic because they had their origins in the era when Greek thought and culture spread to Rome and other Mediterranean regions from the 3rd century BC onwards. Bit of provenance. You want to throw around who was first? Well, there you go. If it matters. My dad's bigger than your dad. They differed in details, but were so close in essentials as to be hard to distinguish much of the time. Like everyone else, Montaigne mixed and matched them according to his needs. Love this guy. All the schools had the same aim, to achieve a way of living known in the original Greek as eudaimonia. Eudaimonia. E-U-D-A-I. Monia. Often translated as happiness or joy, or human flourishing. Now, peel off the dust, take your wire brush and scrape off the rust. The point of Freemasonry is happiness, This, I think, is probably closer to the meaning of that than giggling, acting like schoolboys, pizza and beer. Although pizza and beer, you know, and it's right place, it works. But this, the original Greek eudaimonia, that's the point. That's what we're striving to achieve, a joy, a human flourishing. Maybe when we're talking about the point of Freemasonry, we can start to look at where these things came from, where they started. Might give us a context that will help us pull the meaning out of it. Instead of saying, well, joy and happiness in my current context is a giggle. Well, not amongst mature men. This meant living well in every sense, thriving, relishing life, and being a good person. It didn't say anything about being wealthy, did it? Money doesn't buy happiness. We know that. They also agreed that the best path to eudaimonia was ataraxia, which may be rendered as imperturbability. You'd think I could say... Imperturbability. That's, you got to admit, listening to somebody stumble over imperturbability. Honest to God, don't tell anyone I speak like that when I'm here with you. They also agreed that the best path to eudaimonia was ataraxia, A-T-A-R-A-X-I-A, which means equilibrium. So that human flourishing requires equilibrium. And when I'm talking to you in the past about balance, it's not like I've just, you know, it's like, where do you think this came from? It's like this idea just some doesn't just sort of float in there. I don't have very much going on. It's like, you know, when you read something and all of a sudden it's like these thoughts, these little neurons begin to, these synapses start to connect and think, oh, well, that has to do with balance. And balance has to do with eudaimonia. And the source of that is ataraxia, which is the imperturbability or freedom from anxiety. Ah. Now we're getting somewhere interesting. I begin to think that, you know, my counterpoint and what is that our the point of all of this is about trust. Here, this is a bit of a really juicy point that needs to be discussed. Imperturbability or freedom from anxiety. I love this. Ataraxia means equilibrium, the art of maintaining an even keel so that neither exult when things go well nor plunge into despair when things go awry. Yeah. Take it as it comes. Okay. So I'm thinking something sort of like somebody that acts a bit cool. They don't get flustered. They don't jump up and dance. Oh, everything's wonderful. Oh, everything's not necessarily wonderful. It is what it is. Good things happen. Great. I'll get excited when, you know, a four-year-old member of the family comes up and is showing me a new piece of art. Of course, it's brilliant. That's Picasso. That's what that is. That's pure joy, that smile and that giggle. Between you and I, yeah. And all that gnashing of teeth and that muscularity, really? Not a little old for that crap? To attain is to have control over your emotions so that you are not battered and dragged about by them like a bone fought over by a pack of dogs. It was on the question of how to acquire such equanimity that the philosophies began to diverge. Each had a different idea, for example, of how far one should compromise with the real world. The original Epicurean community, founded by Epicurus in the 4th century BC, required followers to leave their families and live like cult members in a private garden. Skeptics preferred to remain amid the public hurly-burly like everyone else, but with a radically altered mental attitude. Stoics were somewhere in between. The two best-known Stoic writers, Seneca and Epictetus, wrote for an elite Roman readership who were deeply involved in the affairs of their time and had no time for gardens, but who desired oases of tranquility and self-possession wherever they could find them. Hey, I'm in one right here. This is a bloody oasis of tranquility. I've got a whole group of people that I can talk with. Great. And sitting here with all these books full of ideas and and a cell phone that's as smart as Stephen Hawking and Richard Dawkins. I love that. My cell phone's smarter than you are. I just Google it. This is, man, life is good. That's it. And I have self-possession, of course. I mean, you feel good about it. Stoics and Epicureans shared a great deal of the theory, too. They thought that the ability to enjoy life is thwarted by two big weaknesses: lack of control over emotions and a tendency to pay little attention to the present. Oh, dear. This is like my grade one teacher, Mrs. Thornall. Mr. Graham, you pay attention. Yes, Ms. Thornall. If one could only get these, then Ms. Thornall said that I should consider dropping out of school at an early age because I really didn't have much academic ability. Poor old girl. Who knew? Maybe I just did this to piss her off. I love her. One could only get these two things right, controlling and paying attention. Most other problems would take care of themselves. If one could only get these two things right, controlling our emotions and paying attention, most other problems would take care of themselves. The catch is that both... I'm sorry. The catch is that both are almost impossible to do. Oh, I did tell you that the self-improvement was hard, didn't I? Don't be whining. Don't be whining. Get up. Of course it's hard. It's a pain in the pocketbook here. Jeez, man. Control my emotions. All right, here's the mantra. Control my emotion, pay attention. Control my emotion, pay attention. Got it. The catch is that they're impossible. So difficult are they that one cannot approach them head on. It is necessary to sidle in from lateral angles and trick oneself into achieving them. Now, I know a fellow out there, Michael. Now, he's probably the kind of guy that's going to be able to absolutely understand how to move sideways and grasp these ideas. I'm going to have to talk. I think I'm going to try and convince him that he owes me a drink or a cup of coffee or something. Or my friend Derek. I'll get Derek. He's bright. He'll figure this out. Accordingly, Stoic and Epicurean thinkers spend much time devising techniques and thought experiments. For example, thought experiment for the day. I'm not going to give you too much, boys, because after all, I think we're like-minded. Here's your thought experiment for the day. Imagine that today is the last day of your life. There you go, something light. Sun's coming up, yeah. Are you ready to face death? Imagine even that this very moment now is the last moment of your existence. What are you feeling? Do you have regrets? Are the things you wish you had done differently? Are you really alive at this instance? Or are you consumed with panic, denial, and remorse? This experiment opens your eyes to what is important to you and reminds you of how time runs constantly through your fingers. That's it. If I do any more today, it's just going to give me a brain cramp. Honestly, man. Honestly. That's a lot. It's a lot. It's certainly a lot. We need to do some soothing in that. You have a thought experiment for the day. So I can't do better than that. Self-improvement? Go gently. Go easy, man. It's hard. It's difficult. Have I been useful to you today? I honestly hope that I have been. I absolutely do. It wasn't that long ago. Somebody was cutting square compasses into some shore along Goat Island. And the date, 1606, wasn't that long ago. You know, and more likely it was the grave marker of a French stonemason who had settled in Port Royal with Champlain and De Monts in 1605. But the first undoubted accepted mason on this side of the Atlantic was John Skene. On the membership roll of the Lodge of Aberdeen in 1670, he's listed as merchant and mason, and he served as the deputy governor of East Jersey from 1685 to 1690. In a letter by Jonathan Belcher, do you care, the governor of Massachusetts, written on the 25th, he says, an address to the first lodge in Boston, he says, "It is now 37 years since I was admitted into the ancient and honorable Society of Free and Accepted Masons, to whom I have been a faithful brother and well-wisher in the art of masonry. I shall ever maintain a strict friendship for the whole fraternity and always be glad when it may fall in my power to do them any services." Man, I love that. I hope you'll continue to watch out for each other and look for the mason in the man, especially when you can find it in a stranger. Eh? Be gentle with yourself. Be generous. Be patient. If I was mentoring, I like to think that in my mind, I would be able to absorb the anxieties and distress of the talented student, help him to overcome them and to focus on his natural abilities, and to convince him that I'm somebody that he can be that can be trusted, that I can say things candidly without being pithy, that I can say things that are intended to be useful, not talk down or be condescending, but to point out areas where I think he may need to work in order to achieve that perfect note that he's capable of performing. That's in my mind the kind of thing that I'd like to achieve. Commit acts of random Masonic kindness. And remember, the best are the acts when the person doesn't know it's coming from you. They don't even know that you exist. That's the bigger man. I'll see you soon. Don't you think?
Quand devant ma when life goes wrong, try for a little French song. French song armé, be démodé. Si douce affredonnée, French en gartender à l'envie, nostalgique à l'infini. Et quand on ne sait plus when to belong, try for a little French song. French song will take you to Paris, to Piccadilly, Saint-Louis. French en gardant sous la pluie de Bastille aux Tuileries. Because we have de quoi frimer, we have Brassens, Brel and Fevel, we have Boris, Jean, Barbara, Gainsbourg, Trenet, Prévert, Cosma. Because we have de quoi choisir, we have Aznavour et Jenny. Because nous garons Moussaki, Edith, Piaf, Le Clorin, Jenny. Oui, 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 bien sûr, ce n'est pas Duke Ellington, ce n'est pas Elvis ni Jackson, ce n'est pas Fitzgerald ou Armstrong, c'est juste un little French song. We
mais quand le chagrin reste tout long, moi je chante une nuit de fringon. Because we have de quoi frimer, we have Brassens, bread and ferré, we have Boris, Jean, Barbara, qu'un autre n'est prévert que ça. Because we have de quoi choisir, we have Aznavour et Jenny, Beko, Nougaro, Moussaki, Edith, Pierre, Le Cloen, Johnny. Oui, 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 qu'on soit de Londres ou de Hong Kong, qu'on soit Trafalgar et Chobong, qu'on soit Jalapa ou Sarong, try for a little French song. Quand les méchants sonnent leur gong, moi je chante une little French song.
but size eyes. Holding hands, please my heart understand. I'm old-fashioned, but that's how I want to be, as long as you agree to stay old-fashioned with me.